Now, Margaret Atwood's 1985 novel, The Handmaid's Tale, has made the jump to TV. The Hulu series premiered just last week.
Are you all well? Come on, I want you to say we're very well, Aunt Lydia. So, are you well?
Very well, Aunt Lydia.
That's great. Because you are well. You're healthy, you're free from infections, and you're the only ones whose tests are positive. You're the lucky ones.
We're the lucky ones.
Amen. You're going to be handmaids. You're going to serve God and your country.
The book and the show are set in a near future United States after a religious conservative coup. Women are disenfranchised and oppressed, and facing low fertility, women capable of bearing children are conscripted as handmaids of wealthy men and subjected to rape and forced childbirth.
The show has gotten reaction from across the political spectrum, with anti-Trump and pro-choice protesters referring to The Handmaid's Tale in protest signs, and Trump supporters saying it's anti-Trump propaganda.
Alyssa Rosenberg joins us now. She writes about pop culture for The Washington Post's opinion section, where she's covered The Handmaid's Tale. Alyssa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, especially during Pledge Week.
And Alyssa, for people who haven't read or seen The Handmaid's Tale, tell us a little more about the setup.
Sure. It's an interesting book because it's written sort of as a historical document. It's supposed to be the diary of one of the women who lived through this coup, is captured because she's given birth to a healthy child, and forced to work as a handmaid, a position where she is essentially raped by the man who owns her in a quasi-religious ritual that's intended to get her pregnant because the man is married to a woman who is sterile. It's a very unnerving novel, and Atwood intended it to be that way. She said of this and some of her other dystopian fiction that there's nothing in it that didn't exist in the real world. You know, she's drawn from all sorts of biblical sources, historical experiences. And so she wanted to create a world that was uncomfortable because it was recognizable. Now, I think the people who are saying that it's anti-Trump propaganda probably need to get a bit of a refresher on their literary history. This was written in 1985 when, you know, Trump was heading towards, I think, another Atlantic City bankruptcy rather than predicting his election as president of the United States. But if it's resonant, it's because people do feel anxious about women's rights, about what seem like rapid changes in American society, changes in technology and the environment. The Handmaid's Tale is the scenario for the coup involved and sort of Islamic terror attack. So people aren't wrong to see parallels, but the idea that this is about our present day, I think, doesn't necessarily wash. Atwood has called it an anti-prediction, an attempt to forestall a future from coming to pass by describing it in detail. So it may be resonant. We may have reached some of the outcomes that Atwood describe, but those certainly not the more extreme ones, but not necessarily by the roots that she described.
Before we dig more into the kind of political reception of this, is it, as you're watching it, is this good TV? Is this a well-done production? Is this a good thing to watch?
It's fantastic. Elizabeth Moss, who I think a lot of your listeners will be familiar with on Mad Men, is just wonderful as Offred. That's what she's known as. She's a handmaid. Her name is literally of Fred, the man who owns her. And also sort of as June, the woman that she was before the coup, before she was conscripted into this horrifying nightmare position. Reed Morano, who directed the first three episodes, has done a really beautiful job of creating a signature aesthetic for the show. It's almost like a creepy Pinterest board. And Bruce Miller has done a really lovely job adapting Atwood's work in consultation with her, I should know.
And as you pointed out, this is not a perfect match, obviously, for the situation of women in the United States in 2017. But Margaret Atwood, as you mentioned, pulled real things everywhere from the Bible to cultures around the world. I mean, how much resonance is there for people worried about maybe the fragility of the rights of women?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a useful warning. The Bloomberg columnist Megan McArdle, who's a friend of mine, sort of looked at the ways that a radical societal change like the one described in the book could happen. And the truth is, I think it's pretty difficult. We don't have one of the major conditions for the scenario in The Handmaid's Tale, which is a shocking and sudden decline in fertility. you know, the United States has experienced Islamic terrorism in the form of the September 11th attacks. And for all our government took actions that I think challenged our core values as Americans, our society and our electoral system survived. So I think people who feel like our culture and our politics are changing really rapidly aren't necessarily wrong, but I'm not sure that they're changing in precisely the ways or with precisely the speed that Atwood described in The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah, can you talk about this? Again, this has struck a chord. A lot of people are writing about this, tweeting about this, talking about this, even though it isn't necessarily something we're watching for something to happen. This is maybe it happened to be made into a TV show at the right time to get this this conversation going.
Absolutely. The Handmaid's Tale comes at a moment when there's been enormous discussions about the representation of women and the telling of women's stories in so-called prestige television. I say that kind of in air quotes because to a certain extent, what's defined as prestige is often stories about men. That becomes sort of a condition of earning that label. It also comes at a time when television has really matured as a medium. I think it's worth noting that this is a series that's coming out on Hulu, not on a broadcast network or even a network like HBO that gave us so many important shows like The Sopranos, Sex and the City, The Wire, et cetera. So there are more outlets than ever before. There's a maturing conversation about the importance of just telling great women's stories. And there's also a generation of actresses like Moss, like Samira Wiley, who sort of come up with the expectation that there will be these fabulous rich parts for them. Wiley stars or starred until last season on Orange is the New Black. She's a fantastic actress and a tremendous find, but also someone who came up in just a television ecosystem that might not have created great roles for a woman of color like her 10 years ago. Now, because we're at this moment that is sort of being coined peak TV, there are so many new original series coming out. There is both room for a story like The Handmaid's Tale, which is not something that was ever going to be a mass market broadcast hit that drew 40 million viewers a night. And there is, I think, the critical hunger for a story like this with parts for women like this that I think just made it an obvious fit for the moment. There's also an ongoing conversation about the way that feminism is, to a certain extent, being used to sell products and television series. There was some controversy over the way Moss described the show at a panel in New York shortly before it aired. I mean, I think that at the end of the day, it's obvious that The Handmaid's Tale is a feminist story. It's been a feminist story for 32 years, but it also speaks, the moment that this has created the opportunity for this kind of story also means that it's under fairly high scrutiny.
We're talking about The Handmaid's Tale, the new TV show based on Margaret Atwood's novel. Alyssa Rosenberg is with us. She writes for The Washington Post.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you read the book? Are you watching the show? And what do you think of it? Do you think dystopian stories like this one offer valuable warnings about where society could end up? Call 800-642-1234.
We'll continue the conversation and take your calls in just a bit. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we continue our conversation right now with Alyssa Rosenberg from The Washington Post, looking at The Handmaid's Tale, the TV show based on the Margaret Atwood novel. And it's getting a lot of attention right now across the political spectrum.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you read the book? Are you watching the TV show? More generally, do you read dystopian fiction? Watch these sort of after the apocalypse types of movies. They're big these days. 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. Liz is with us in Waukesha. Liz, hi.
Hey there. Just a couple of comments and then one question, and I'll take your answer off the air. This is one of my all-time favorite novels and one that I think everyone should be required to read before they die. And I have not watched the show yet, but my passion for this book specifically is because it's not so far-fetched, and it scares me when I see people who identify as Christians behaving like ISIS. And thank you so much for taking my comments, and have a wonderful afternoon.
Liz, thanks for the call. Liz loves the book, very worried about the future. Alyssa, is this a reaction we're seeing from a lot of people?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people responded in particular to Trump's election of Mike Pence, who is, I think, much more defined by his Christianity and by the consistency of his hard right beliefs as his vice president than necessarily Trump himself. I mean, Trump doesn't really resemble the characters, the regime in The Handmaid's Tale in any way. He's not, I think, as far as we can tell, a particularly religious person. He's not someone of necessarily terribly deep convictions about either his religion or the way to fix the world. And so he seems to me like an unlikely candidate for a theocratic coup. I'm not saying that to be flip. I think that for people who are sort of anxious about the imagery about things like that are coming out of the administration, like attempts to cut funding for Planned Parenthood, the resonances feel really real and upsetting. What I find really interesting about having The Handmaid's Tale in the air in this particular moment is that it's a reminder that we can get some of the same results, like limitations on women's reproductive rights or very traditionalist gender roles, not necessarily only through one route. You know, it doesn't necessarily take someone who is a very extreme religious conservative to implement these kinds of views. It can be someone who, you know, views himself as sort of a player, sees women as not necessarily as sort of objects of dangerous sexual temptation, but as objects. You can get to the same unnerving end by very different roads.
Alyssa, as we wrap up, just briefly talking, you've written a little more widely about dystopian fiction and TV and movies. What's the role of that? It's not so much, here's a warning sign, I think this is exactly the bad thing that's going to happen. So what do we get out of dystopian books, TV, movies?
I think the thing I've been getting out of them lately, and talking not just about The Handmaid's Tale, but something like Richard Kelly's Southland Tales, is the sense that my feelings of dislocation and strangeness are not necessarily mine alone, that I'm not insane to feel like things are changing really rapidly or that our politics or our culture have become almost unrecognizable to me, but in fact that feeling of strangeness is shared. And so I think that dystopian fiction is not necessarily a hopeful genre. It can be a warning, but in this case, I found it to be at least mildly comforting, although I guess that's not saying much.
We'll leave it there for now. Alyssa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure.
We've been talking to Alyssa Rosenberg. She writes about pop culture for the Washington Post opinion section. We've been talking about The Handmaid's Tale, the Margaret Atwood novel, turned now into a Hulu TV series. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's no secret that the relationship between presidents and the press can be tense, but it has been especially contentious with President Trump.
On the campaign trail last year, candidate Trump floated the idea of making changes to libel laws that affect the press. Since then, he has slammed members of the news media, like the New York Times, for their coverage. The idea of changing libel laws was mentioned again by members of the administration this week. Here's a clip of White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus talking to ABC's George Carl on This Week.
First of all, there was what he said about opening up the libel laws, tweeting, "The failing New York Times has disgraced the media world, gotten me wrong for two solid years. Change the libel laws." That would require, as I understand it, a constitutional amendment. Is he really going to pursue that? Is that something he wants to pursue?
I think it's something that we've looked at, and how that gets executed or whether that goes anywhere is a different story.
Mike Wagner joins us now. He's an associate professor at UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Mike, so far there's nothing solid to go on in terms of changes to libel laws, no legislation to look at. But in general, if it got easier, say, for the president to sue reporters, what would that mean for the media?
Well, I think it would mean that, you know, given President Trump's history in the world of business, that he would probably be likely to use lawsuits as ways to threaten opponents. And so if he saw opponents in the news media, which I think it's clear that he does, you know, he might be expected to, if he thought he had a chance in court, use the idea or the threat or the actual use of lawsuits to try to silence critics, intimidate critics, punish those who printed or aired things that weren't true, and so forth.
And for reporters, what would it mean to be a little more vulnerable in your reporting when it came to legal ramifications?
Well, I think if reporters became more vulnerable, if libel laws were changed in some kind of way, it would potentially influence how reporters covered some stories, or could at least, depending upon how these laws might be changed, but of course I think that's extraordinarily unlikely, but it's possible that it could have a silencing effect on critical coverage of the news media. It could be, you know, situations where it's more of a, you know, one person said this versus another person said that, those stories might be a little more harder to come by in terms of actually, you know, making it to print or being uploaded to the site or being aired in a broadcast situation. But that's all, you know, pretty speculative, I would say, at this point, especially given the lack of likelihood of much changing.
And we're talking about First Amendment rights here, freedom of speech, and to do anything with this, it seems like it would require an amendment. Does that seem likely to you?
It does not seem likely. Right now, the Supreme Court has established a fairly firm and long-standing standard for what has to happen for reporters to be found guilty of libeling a public figure. And basically what has to happen is the person who thinks they've been libeled has to be able to prove what's called actual malice, which means that the reporter knew that they were reporting something that wasn't true and reported it anyway. So it's not just that reporters did something incorrect. So getting a fact wrong is not libel. Getting a fact wrong when you knew it was wrong and your opponent was able to prove that you knew you were wrong, that would be something that would be a situation where you could be found guilty of libel. That's a pretty difficult standard, which is why we don't see many cases that are successful anymore. And it's been that way for 55, 60 years since the New York Times versus Sullivan case in the 1960s.
Do you think that a change to libel laws would inevitably mean that it would curtail freedom of speech or press freedom, or could it also make the press more accountable, maybe more careful in its reporting?
Well, I think, there are already plenty of mechanisms to make the press careful and accountable in their reporting. Most newspapers run a corrections page when they make errors. Most broadcast organizations will note when they make errors. Plenty of people are willing to point out to reporters when people think reporters are wrong, whether that be in a letter to the editor or on Twitter or Facebook or, other ways of communicating with members of the news media. And so there are plenty of ways to hold journalists accountable, including other journalists. You know, when someone gets something wrong, other journalists are quick to point that out. And when they do, it's a reminder across the board in the profession, that there are consequences for getting things wrong. And in a profession where you're really trying to report the verifiable truth, trust is critically important. And eroding that trust by getting stuff wrong all the time is a terrible strategy as a news organization, which is why reporters tend to work so hard to get things right.
I mean, that corrections page, people have complained over the years that the story runs, there's an error, the damage is done, and nobody reads the corrections page. I mean, social media might be an outlet that's more immediate, but as far as the corrections pages go, is there more there that could happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it would be more useful if the correction was as big as the original claim. And so if the story was on the front page and something was wrong, the correction, in my opinion, ought to be on the front page as well. But yeah, it is the case that, the first thing people hear tends to be the thing that sticks with them the most when they're learning new information. And so, tons of studies have shown that when a fact is initially reported incorrectly, many people tend to believe that even after the corrections happen. And so there are consequences, but that's part of having a free press. That's part of living in a free society. The news media, like all other things, are not perfect.
So looking at President Trump's dissatisfaction with some of the libel laws and some of his experiences with the press, do you think that his comments, I mean, should we be interpreting them to mean he has actual intention, or do you think he's saying, hey, I'm dissatisfied with things, and maybe I'm doing a little saber rattling here?
Well, not being able to look into the president's mind, it's hard to know for sure, but I think the quote you played from Reince Priebus, the soundbite you played from his chief of staff, was really telling, right? He said, well, it's something we've looked at, but whether that's likely is a whole other thing. And I think that is Washington speak for this isn't going anywhere.
I want to play a clip now. The president made an unconventional move over the weekend when he decided not to attend the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And we have heard a comedian, Hasan Minhaj, who is performing. He had something to say about the fact that Trump chose not to be there. He went to a rally instead. Here's a little bit.
Only in America can a first-generation Indian-American Muslim kid get on this stage and make fun of the president. The orange man behind the Muslim ban. And it's a sign to the rest of the world. It's this amazing tradition that shows the entire world that even the president is not beyond the reach of the First Amendment. But the president didn't show up. Because Donald Trump doesn't care about free speech. The man who tweets everything that enters his head refuses to acknowledge the amendment that allows him to do it.
And pretty strong line of comedy, if you call it that, or commentary, rather, by the comedian hosting there, Hasan Minhaj. What do you hear in that clip, Mike?
Well, I think I hear the comedian expressing a frustration that many opponents of the president, many members of the news media, many people in the president's own party, a wide variety of people feel about how the president has treated the news media, calling them an enemy of the state, saying that he wants to, perhaps change libel laws as a way to kind of threaten the silencing of reporters. And so I think you're hearing, from the White House correspondent, Speaker Hasan Minhaj, I think you're hearing just an expression of frustration, and also that expression occurring through a statement of traditional American values, like upholding the First Amendment, like the powerful being held to account by the press and the people, and things that we traditionally think about when we think as Americans about what makes us unique as a country.
Now, President Trump, as we said, he has had this especially contentious relationship with the press. Is this unusual, or is this something that we've seen before if you look back through the years?
Oh, I think when you've had a president, you've had a person who's had a contentious relationship with the press in one way or another. That's true of President Obama. That's true of President Clinton, both President Bush's and President Reagan. Through the annals of American history, the relationship is almost always a contentious one. But usually the president will say, or will complain about the questions that get asked or the issues the news media focus on, but not about the news media's right to do it. And it's very rare to have presidents engage in the kind of consistent, systematic complaining about news coverage that doesn't make them look good, especially in the public way that President Trump does it. That's pretty unique, especially with respect to the sustained way that he keeps doing it.
So as someone who's with the Department of Journalism and Mass Communication, are there any particular signs that you're looking for to see what direction this relationship might take and what we might expect in terms of maybe actual legal changes in the terms of libel or other directions that affect the media?
Well, I think the first place to look is the changing norms between the relationship between the president and the news media, the president and the public, the president and other foreign leaders, the president and Congress. And we see that one way President Trump has been a unique president is in the breakdown of a lot of norms. The president has engaged in conversations with foreign leaders without telling his own State Department. The president didn't go to the White House Correspondents' Dinner. The president has engaged in lots of kinds of behaviors that break down traditional norms. And so that's something that I, think is important for us as a citizenry, and especially important for the news media to watch and chronicle so that people can decide for themselves whether the breakdown of these norms is a good thing or not.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Mike Wagner, associate professor at UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, joining us there to talk about libel laws after members of the Trump administration said the White House was considering changing them.